This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte, and we kick off our Reporters Roundtable Thursday today with a conversation with Grant Morgan. He's with the Post Tribune, and a couple major stories you've had in the paper with your byline on it and online, by the way, too. Thanks for being with us today.
Mr. Nolte, thanks for having me.
Well, you're welcome. Let's start in here with the conversation that that you had out there in print and online concerning the latest concerning, I guess, Dr. Ulrich Klaufer, we should say. He is the late Dr. Klaufer. We should mention he passed away not long ago, but he's best known now for being considered entitled, I guess, as the title that I know has been kicked around in other media, as the abortion doctor. And your story talks about, I guess, the latest investigation that's happened not only here in Indiana, but over in Illinois.
Yeah, it's something that's pretty difficult to wrap your head around. On September 12th or September 13th, more than 2,000 preserved fetal remains were found in the garage of his Illinois home. And ever since then, authorities, people, lawmakers have been asking, what do we do about it? Where did they come from? How did they get there? Was it illegal? And how are we going to dispose of them?
Mm-hmm. Now, I understand that this actually is not, I guess, a relatively new case, where it's only a few years old, but still it goes back to 2016. That was the last time that, I guess, Dr. Klaufer, when he was still alive and still in practice, had actually been, I guess, accused of conducting abortion. So this does go back a ways. And you discovered, I guess, in the information that you've dug up and put in the stories, I guess, that he had, of course, operated a clinic here in Gary, and then mm-hmm. over in South Bend, and then Fort Wayne. So it's kind of spread out. I guess, does that kind of add on to the, I guess, the surprising number of remains that were found over in that garage in Will County?
Yeah, he had three clinics in Indiana, and that's, in fact, where he did pretty much all his abortions. Early in his career, he might have done some in Illinois, but those are pretty difficult to find records of. So we have three clinics in Indiana, Gary, Fort Wayne, and South Bend. According to some people, the guy did upwards of 30,000 abortions throughout his career, which stretched back into the 70s. Yeah. So when you think about it that way, the remains of 2,246, that is not so surprising. But what is surprising is just the fact that he had them and that they were medically preserved in his home.
Yeah, I guess we should mention that these are discoveries that were made just recently in that garage at his home there in Cree Township in Illinois.
Right.
When the discovery came about, and I guess that we had, of course, the news conferences, I guess, first when this all came about and the discovery in Illinois, we had the news conferences with the Will County Sheriff and the Will County Prosecutor, and then it's finally kind of developed even further into some news conferences that happened in Indiana, and that was involving, I guess, Indiana Attorney General Curtis Hill. Tell us what you found out in that information that came about. Is Hill's response to everything that had happened not only in Indiana, but over in Illinois?
Yeah, the difficulty is that there are now two states that have to deal with this. Klaufer only did abortions in Indiana. However, because the remains were found in Illinois, both of the attorney generals have gotten involved. However, what has ultimately been decided is that the Indiana attorney general is going to take jurisdiction. So the remains are going to be sent back to Indiana, and Indiana will be the one conducting sort of investigations into any crimes that might be, any crime leads that might come from this discovery. There's also a hotline for women who, you know, might have been operated on by Dr. Klaufer and who now, you know, when this news comes out, are feeling pretty shocked that, you know, their fetal remains could have been preserved and they didn't know anything about it. So the Indiana Attorney General is taking over. However, I do want to make the distinction that Dr. Klaufer suffered quite a few state investigations while he was practicing. Mm-hmm. And just like you said, his licenses were suspended in 2016 in Indiana. But that's a separate issue from what's coming out now, which is that he preserved those remains.
Yeah.
The investigations into that are something totally different.
I know that you mentioned in your stories in print and online about what came out at that news conference that A.G. Hill had mentioned here about the laws that he was going to take a look at, I guess, as to see if they would in turn be appropriate in the investigation. Tell us what he had mentioned about these laws, I guess, about the involving the fetuses and disposal of them.
Yeah, there are a few legal aspects of this discovery. The first is that Indiana has a somewhat controversial law on the books that the Supreme Court upheld requiring the burial or cremation of fetal remains, which is different from disposing of them as medical waste, as they were previously disposed of. And so that's one law that is going to have to be navigated because that's a new law. But these remains that were found were from the years 2000 to 2002. When the laws regarding the disposal of remains were much, much different. So the Indiana Attorney General has to figure out the proper way to dispose of the remains regarding either that former law or the current law, which is a little bit more strict. Mm-hmm. Another legal avenue regarding this case is crimes that might have been committed that Dr. Klopfer never reported. So, for example, Dr. Klopfer once testified that he performed an abortion on a teenage girl who was raped by her uncle, sad as that is. However, he never reported that to authorities, the rape part of that, which could have been a crime. So in examining the records attached to these fetal remains that were discovered recently, crimes could have been committed, or at least information about the crime could be found by sort of how old the women were who got the abortions, the story behind the abortion, and names attached to that story. Now, that nothing has come out officially from the Indiana Attorney General regarding that, so that's just a possibility.
Mm-hmm. One other thing I'd like to ask, if you go into more detail about it, it's in your story, too, so you can check it out online and in print, concerning the discovery of all of these remains in the garage, and what I guess the family attorney, Mr. Bolger, had to say to everybody, I'm assuming at one of the news conferences or maybe in your contact with him, about the fact that there were so many remains, and it surprised the family so much that had they, after Dr. Klopfer had passed away, had they obviously not gone to the property, or did they just not check every place and they made that discovery?
The remains were stored in plastic bags with a medical chemical, formalin, and they were stored also in boxes that were stacked floor to ceiling in the garage. That's what we've been told, at least.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're right. There are a lot of questions about if there were so many of them, how did no one know and all that. But you have to take things at face value of what people tell you. And what we've been told is that they were there, but no one had any idea that it was going on.
And the other thing I wanted to ask while we have time here on this particular story is what you mentioned in your story about how the folks here in Northwest Indiana have graciously decided they're going to help take care of the remains of these fetuses. And it's something to note because it's in Northwest Indiana where I guess they'll be taken care of.
Yeah. A couple dioceses have, the Gary Diocese and then the South Bend Fort Wayne Diocese,
mm-hmm.
have offered to bury the remains free of charge with services and things like that. And it's yet to be seen what the Indiana Attorney General will do about that. It's pretty much too early in the investigation.
Okay. The other story I wanted to have a chance, while we still have a chance to talk today, to bring us kind of up to date, is the latest involving Samantha El-Hassani. We've talked with her about her before. In fact, the last time we were on the air during Regionally Speaking, and to bring us an update, if you will, about how the case is coming along, the trial, I guess, which is still scheduled to be had, but there's some new developments, if we understand about this. Bring us up to date, please.
Sure. This is a fascinating case. Samantha El-Hassani is being charged in federal court with aiding and abetting a terrorist group, notably ISIS. She spent a few years in Syria. She's from Indiana, or sorry, not Indiana originally, but you know, she lived in Elkhart.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So she went over to Syria with her fiance before he was eventually killed in some attacks from a U.S.-led coalition. And there are so many aspects to this case that I'm going to try to focus it for you because I know that's what you want.
Mm-hmm.
Most recent thing is that the lawyers for El-Hassani they need some testimony from people who are still in Iraq, and it's going to be super difficult to get because they're stateless people, and the lawyers don't know which government they have to go to in order to see if they can go over there and interview those people, if they can even find them.
I suppose that they could technically just talk to them, because we'll assume that they're in a refugee camp someplace over there. But you mentioned the point, and the story's mentioned this too, about the fact that you don't know which authority to go to get permission to take the depositions.
Exactly. And the lawyer for El-Hassani said during one hearing in Hammond, he said that the government was sort of egging him on, testing him to see whether he could actually get this done, go over there and get the testimony, because there are so many obstacles in the way. One is that they're stateless. Two is that, that's pretty much the big one. They're stateless. What government, because you usually need a government to authorize those conversations, right? Foreign depositions, they need to be authorized by the sovereign authority there. But who is a sovereign authority for a stateless person? That's a good question.
Right. We probably should mention, too, for people that have kind of come along in this story, and we've talked in the past about it, but to bring everybody up to date, there's a reason why the federal government is interested in having Ms. El-Hassani go to trial, which it is now going to happen. She's involved in a case that's gotten involved with something that we've all had heard much about, of course, in the news about ISIS. Tell us how she's connected with all of this.
Sure. She married a guy who, and again, these are all allegations, but the allegations are that she helped her husband and his brother secure gear to then use when they joined ISIS.
Mm-hmm.
However, the thing to remember is that all of the government's allegations against Samantha El-Hassani deal with her time, not when she was in ISIS-controlled territory in Syria, which she was, but before that took place. She took multiple trips to, I believe it was Hong Kong, and she also was in Turkey with her husband. And that's the problem, because if she got tactical gear for her husband in either of those places, that would be the thing that would convict her of helping ISIS, not her actually living in ISIS-controlled mm-hmm. territory.
Now, we only have just a few seconds left. Grant, if you will, give us an idea of, at least unless things change on the court docket, when is this case likely to come up to trial now?
They want it to come up in January, but they're still trying to get depositions from these people they don't even know they can get depositions from. And just a quick note, mm-hmm. the people that they're looking for the depositions from were slaves that were bought by her husband. It was two female sex slaves and one young boy who was actually used in ISIS propaganda videos after he was purchased. And they're Yazidis. It's a religious minority that's severely persecuted by ISIS over there. And so since we're only still looking at depositions, there's not much of a chance that this trial is going to come up in January.
Yeah, that's one of the things you mentioned in your other story, the first story that we've had a chance to talk with you about that came up when it came out of court, was the fact that this is going to be this deposition taking, if it does happen, number one, and number two, if it happens relatively recently, is going to have a major effect on how the rest of the case is going to handle, the trial to be sure, because you know that the defense attorneys will get their depositions or try to, and if they do, then of course they'll have to hand over information to the U.S. Attorney office. They'll want to take a look at it as well too, so that everybody is familiar with it before it actually does go before the judge
exactly.
go to trial. So there are lots
exactly.
of lots of things that get in the way, and is that people familiar with the legal process, and particularly the U.S. District Court legal process, know it's going to take a while to be sure. So we just say stay tuned, because this will come up again, I'm sure, very soon. But in the meantime, I know, Grant, that you will have other great stories that we'll have a chance to talk with you about in the future that'll show up in print and online. We thank you for spending time with us on these two today.
Yeah, appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
You're entirely welcome. Grant Morgans, reporter for the Post-Tribune, and you're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. An Indiana State Senator who has served 14 years has decided to run for Indiana Attorney General. And that state senator is Karen Talion. She talked with Lakeshore Public Radio's Sharon Jackson recently about why she's running and what she would like to do in the AG's office if she's elected.
I understand that you have decided to run for Indiana Attorney General. Can you tell me what made your decision, how you came about making that decision?
Yeah, and it was tough because, you know, I've enjoyed my work in the Senate, but I've been asked by several people, and I was thinking about it. But then, you know, I think one of the things that really pushed me over the edge was Curtis Hill's decision to file the lawsuit to get or to overturn health care. And it would, you know, doing that would put thousands of people either without health care or without care for pre-existing conditions, and I don't think that's right. So I think this AG should be the advocate for people, for consumer protection, and not trying to take away health care. So that was one of the biggest things that pushed me.
Were there other things that he did that you disagreed with?
Well, I've disagreed with him since he walked in the door. I disagreed with his trying to push marriage between one man, one woman into the Republican platform. I've disagreed with his position on marijuana. I've disagreed with most things that he's done. So this was just one more.
And what are your positions on those things?
Well, I think that the first thing that I would do if I got into the office would be to remove Indiana from that lawsuit. You know, this would jeopardize our HIP 2.0 program, which was a Republican program, by the way, and that just has to stop. The other things, I think, you know, we have a problem with payroll fraud and employee misclassification here. You know, some people just think that this is a labor issue, but this is really a business issue. We have a lot of legitimate businesses, contractors and others who are, you know, doing business the right way and playing by the rules. And when you get some people who don't play by the rules, who pay their employees cash under the table or who classify people as 1099s when they really should be doing withholding, you know, it's bad for the businesses that play by the rules. So we've been trying to work on this for years at the State House, and we haven't gotten very far. So as AG, I believe it's one of the things that I would want to do is to set up a unit for fraud investigation.
So what else do you plan to do once you're in there, if you should be elected?
Here's the thing, you know, let me tell you about the latest on the marijuana. We twice have passed laws in the legislature to do something with CBD oil, and both times we've messed it up, or two out of three times we've messed it up, and we've got a problem right now with the legislation that we just passed this year. And I think that an active attorney general who's willing to say to the legislature, look, what you're doing is wrong, or it's illegal, or it's unconstitutional, you know, telling them that up front with a voice of authority is a role that the AG's office could have.
You think it'd be like a power issue, though, because since, you know, the House and the Senate are both Republican and you're Democrat and you know, they're comfortable and used to having that majority. Do you think that they would try to find a way to, you know, oust you somehow?
Well, somebody's actually asked me. They said, Talion, you know, if you're elected AG, the next thing you know, they'll make it an appointed position. I certainly hope not. I would certainly think that's a dangerous thing to do for either party because it can come around and bite you. And so,
how could it? How could it come around and bite?
Well, I mean, if the Republicans say, oh, we want it to be appointed, and then you get a Democrat governor, it would be hurting them. And the same thing with the Democrats. If the Democrats said, hey, we want to appoint this a position by the governor, and then you get a Republican governor, it just consolidates power. Now, I think that the AG's office can be, has the opportunity to be a balance between the governor, the legislature. You know, if the AG's office comes out with an opinion and says, listen, what you're doing, you know, this bill as it's written is illegal, and they pass it anyway and sign it anyway, they're on notice when the next person comes and sues them over, you know, over that legislation.
Has that happened before? Has the state of Indiana ever been sued for legislation that they've passed?
Well, absolutely. I mean, we've spent millions of dollars defending lawsuits against legislation that everybody knew was bad. I've had conversations with legislators about certain bills, and you know, I said, you know what you're doing is against the law. Oh, yeah, we know. We're trying to change the law. We're trying to challenge a court decision, you know, and they know that, and they do it anyway. But if you had an attorney general in the office saying, ding, you can't do that.
So let me ask you this real quick. Does your decision to run for AG have anything to do with the accusations that were against AG Hill for the accusations of groping?
Let me be careful when I answer this. I think it means what he's doing in the office is the reason that I'm running. And the fact that we need balance in the state house is the reason that I'm running. The fact that he has gotten himself into a mess of trouble means that he's more vulnerable, but, you know, and it might make a run easier, but that's not the reason that I'm running.
Is there anything else that you want to add that maybe I haven't asked you about?
Well, let me just say this. You know, I don't even know if Curtis Hill is going to be my opponent. He has a disciplinary action in October, I think October, and he still has to get the nomination. You know, this is not a primary. This is a convention nomination. He still has to gain his party's nomination at their convention next summer. So I don't know if I'm going to be running against Curtis Hill. But I am running on my own record, what I have always, you know, done for the last 14 years in the State House, and what I think ought to be done in the Attorney General's office.
So this is a convention nomination. So when does that happen? When will you know whether or not you got the nomination? And then it goes to the general?
The convention nomination will be at our conventions. The Democrat convention is June of 2020, it might be the 15th, I'm not sure, of the date. And then the Republicans, I'm not sure, they usually hold theirs right after the Democrats. So, yeah, it'll be June of next year.
So why is it not a primary? Why doesn't it not go to the primary election?
I don't know, Sharon. There were two offices that were convention slates. One of them is Attorney General. Well, actually, so is the Lieutenant Governor's position officially. So Lieutenant Governor, the Attorney General, and used to be the Superintendent of Public Instruction.
Is this just an Indiana thing, or is this everywhere?
No, as far as I know, it's an Indiana thing. Every state will do it differently.
Thank you so much. Any other dates that we can look forward to? How are you going to campaign? Do you have any insights that you want to tell us on what you're going to do and how you're going to win this thing? I mean, I know you ran for governor before, but then didn't you? You kind of backed out of that, right?
I did that, yeah, relatively early. It was pretty clear that you know, most of the support was going to go to John Gregg. And, you know, I was not going to be the reason that the Democrat Party had a gubernatorial primary. So we worked out our differences. But I don't know that anybody, I mean, you have to be an attorney to run for this office. So that automatically kind of limits the field. And then, you know, maybe somebody else will step forward. But right now I've got a lot of support from, you know, from a lot of different groups.
And you went to Valparaiso Law School?
I did.
When did you graduate?
When?
Yeah.
1990.
That's Indiana State Senator Karen Talion, who is from the Ogden Dunes area in Portage, talking about her upcoming run for Indiana Attorney General. Inside Indiana Business is each week a group of insiders that gets together with the host, Gary Dick, to offer some perspective on some of the week's top stories. And this week we put together a compilation of some of the most talked about topics, including a look at education, innovation, and health. And Gary Dick starts out the conversation with what he calls an eye on economics.
Well, how strong is Indiana's economy if a recession were to hit? KSM Location Advisor CEO Tim Cook and also President Katie Culp are here to weigh in this month's Eye on Economic Development segment. Welcome, as always.
Thanks.
Hi, Gary.
A lot of discussion about the R word, recession, not only here in Indiana, but all over the country, differing opinions on it. There was the piece a few weeks ago in the Wall Street Journal focused on Elkhart and the RV industry, and maybe that's a leading indicator that things may be headed to recession. Any feel, Tim, I'll start with you on that, as to if we are headed to a recession or a downturn?
Yeah, I think we see what everybody else sees as far as articles and what's happening with the economy in general. I think part of what I've noticed, especially over the last month or two, is just anecdotally as I talk to our clients, CEOs, there does seem to be some hesitancy that wasn't there 6 months, a year ago. So I think if you look at that in tandem with just what are some of the traditional signs of the economy, it does feel different now than it did earlier in the year.
Yeah, Katie, your take on that. You hear a lot of, as Tim said, a lot of anecdotal kind of commentary and indicators that maybe it's on the way. Anything additional that you see?
Yeah, you know, certainly there's some economic indicators. You can look at cap rates, and real estate often responds early as a trend. But what I'm seeing overall is like almost a sense of urgency among companies. You know, they're trying to hurry up and get the board approval or the financing through whatever means. Mm-hmm. Locked down because there's a sense that they're anticipating it's coming.
Mm-hmm. How about the impact as you look at different industries? Certainly Indiana's a manufacturing state primarily, but obviously has other industries as well. As you look at the impact, depending on the industry, what are the factors that go into that?
Yeah, well, if it's industrial, I think you feel the impact because some of those big capital intensive projects, they really kind of, they trail off. When you're looking at tech, it's not so much capital intensive, but it's number of jobs being created. Some of that slows down. Sometimes there's layoffs. So I think that capital versus hiring is the big differentiator.
As we look at a recession or a downturn, Katie, do you look at the differences rural versus urban? What are we looking at there?
Well, you know, when businesses lay off or close, it's devastating anywhere, but particularly so in a rural area where a lot of times the economy isn't as diverse and there are not as many other jobs to absorb layoffs and that type of thing. So I think there's a lot of discussion about quality of place and how important that is to some of these rural communities, but a diverse economic base is also really critical, and you see it play out that way.
Yeah, the consequences, the impact in terms of a downturn, a recession, workforce. So, Katie, I'll start with you on that. What happens, the obvious indicators are people lose their jobs, but what are some of the factors that go into it from a workforce standpoint?
Well, I think it has some pretty broad impact. So, in a way, it's good for employers a little bit because anywhere you go, regardless of sector or location, it's really challenging to find workers right now. So, for a temporary time, it's good. You can find them more easily. But I think the millennial impact, but I think in other parts of the economy, you're going to see less emphasis on some of the programs that have been really beneficial, like ex-convicts getting jobs and other disenfranchised populations getting work opportunities. I think some of those efforts trail off because it's no longer needed to find bodies to fill positions.
How about that millennial impact?
Yeah, you know, it's kind of interesting because millennials, as long as they've been in the workforce, they've been the buyers in a buyer's market, and they've never really lived through a recession. So I think what we'll really track is once a recession does hit, how does that change both their approach and employers and how they look at amenities, wages, all the different things where I think some people feel the millennials have really dictated what is going to happen in the marketplace, and that could flip on its head.
How about deal flow? When you look at economic development, the deal flow obviously is impacted.
Yeah. Right now, I think we see the same level of deal flow as we typically have.
Maybe even a little higher, don't you think?
Yeah, it's. I mean, it's been a...
They're trying to get it all done.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I mean, it's been a strong year. I kind of go back to that comment at the beginning. The anecdotal, you sense some kind of lacking in where's this thing headed in the next 6 to 12 months. But as far as the deal flow, it's as strong as it's ever been.
Is it? Okay. Tech versus industrial impact.
Yeah.
I think the industrial piece, you know, those are harder to redevelop, right? Mm-hmm. So as those close, I think those are going to pose challenges to cities because they have the heavy equipment there, and what do you do with it? The tech, I think that'll be really interesting from an HR perspective, like what Tim talks about. I'm exaggerating a bit, but, you know, a millennial may be less concerned about which employer allows them to take their dog to work and more about, like, if there's a right. position available.
Yeah, interesting. Now, how about when it comes to government? And certainly incentives are part of the economic development game. Does government, economic development agencies, do they change their strategy or their willingness to give incentives in an economic downturn?
Yeah, you see it on the front end and on the back end. On the back end, when it comes to compliance, states, cities, they'll say, have these companies hired the number of people they committed to? And if they have not done that, sometimes they can claw back those incentives. Mm-hmm. But a weird thing happens when there's a recession. They seem more hesitant to enforce some of that because, you know, they don't want to pile on if this is a business that's already struggling. Yeah. We don't want to then claw back the incentives. So even though they've got more authority to do it, oftentimes they put the brakes on those efforts.
And we've talked about this before, but the importance of incentives. They're important, but they're not as important as some. They get all the headlines, or a lot of the headlines,
right.
You know, tax abatement, those types of things. But how important are incentives?
I think they really are an important factor. But what's interesting on the front end is when economies are doing well, rising tides lift all boats, and that state and local government anywhere tends to be a little more particular about who they are willing to incentivize. When you hit a downturn in the economy, all of a sudden the projects that they may not have looked at before as interesting become a lot more compelling. And so you do see these trends in how incentives are offered, what the thresholds are to meet the qualifications and stuff. So it's a full circle.
This is totally a guess, obviously, but as you look at the crystal ball looking to 2020, any feeling as to when we might begin to get a better feel for what's actually going to happen?
Yeah, I think some of the timing in a bad way could be serendipitous when you're having these signs. We're going to go into a presidential election year.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Right.
Last quarter or last 6 months, as always, a slowdown anyway. Mm-hmm. So hopefully that doesn't happen, but I think that's a risk.
Yeah. Interesting perspective as always. Tim Cook, Katie Culp from KSM Location Advisors. Thanks very much. Well, Indiana Campus Compact is celebrating a nearly $1 million three-year Lilly grant that will help it prepare more college students to advance the public good in their communities. ICC is a nonprofit partnership of Indiana's public, private, and community college, higher institution, or education institutions, focused on advocating, implementing, also improving community engagement efforts so that students graduate as well-informed and engaged members of society. In our Eye on Education segment this week, pleased to welcome Indiana Campus Compact Executive Director J.R. Jameson and UND Junior and ICC grant recipient Allie Nickerson to talk about the program. And welcome.
Thanks for having
us.
Yeah, absolutely. J.R., we'll start with you and give us really the thumbnail description of the Campus Compact, because it's been around for a number of years.
Yeah, that's right.
So tell us about the model.
Yeah, and the name isn't intuitive. So the compact is an agreement. And it's an agreement among Indiana institutions of higher education to be dedicated to their communities. Mm-hmm. It started out as an easy way for institutions to show their communities that they care about this type of work, but it's now grown into actually taking action in communities and working with communities through place-based work. Mm-hmm. And so looking at themselves as anchor institutions around economic development, ranging all the way to student volunteerism. And we support our campuses, meet them where they are, and provide opportunities for their students to engage with communities in those types of ways.
Yeah, and you do work across the board, public institutions, private, two-year colleges.
That's right. Yeah, we have 44 institutions as a part of our compact, mm-hmm. and that is actually about 70 campuses, because we have all of the IUs, all of the mm-hmm. Purdue's, all of Ivy Tech. And so, yeah, we're working all the way from the Chicagoland down to Louisville.
All right, Allie, you are a junior at UIndy,
yes.
Right, and a political science and communication major. Talk about your connection to the Compact and how it has really made a difference in a major initiative you've been involved in.
So in 2018, my mentor and I, Dr. Laura Merrifield Wilson, applied for a grant through Indiana Campus Compact and the Campus Election Engagement Project. We started a annual project called UIndy Votes. At its core, it was a voter registration drive, but thanks to support from the Indiana Campus Compact, we were able to expand it into a registration, education, and mobilization project that we may not have been able to complete without their support.
Yeah, that's key, I think. You wouldn't have been able to do it without that support. What, in your view, as you look to 2 years from now, you'll be out into the quote-unquote real world, how will this experience enhance or really impact your professional career?
As political science majors, me and my peers are incredibly politically engaged and interested. Mm-hmm. And so through this voter registration project, we were really able to practice meeting the community where they are and making the democratic process accessible for people in and around the UIndy community. Mm-hmm. And I think those skills are incredibly transferable. I think that we have the opportunity to use those skills to make the democratic process more widely available. Mm-hmm. And also relatable to people to explain why it's so important.
Yeah. And JR, some big news for the Compact recently with a Lilly endowment grant, $1 million over a 3-year period that will enable the Compact to really engage in some different areas, right?
Yeah, we're really excited about that. Our partnership with Lilly expands back to the late 90s. And what will be different about this particular grant is that we're continuing our community engagement efforts, much like Ali described. But what will change is that we're helping our students think about this work through a critical engagement lens. So for instance, you may be volunteering with a homeless shelter, but really, let's dig deep down into that and look at what are the societal issues under that? What are the underlying issues? And how do we help students think critically about that rather than just serving their community? And that's going to help us as a society in the end, right? Because what that's going to do is help students understand their role in a society. Mm-hmm. And when they're working for an organization, that's going to help them think about not just their organization and doing good in that community, but how can the organization really unpack broader things that are happening.
All right, Compass Compact making a difference around the state of Indiana with a number of institutions. J.R. Jamison, the executive director of the Compact, also Allie Nickerson, UIndy student. Thank you both. Good luck to you, the rest of your schooling, and into your professional career as well.
Thank you for having us.
It's time now to go inside innovation. Well, in just a few weeks, it is one of Indy Women in Tech's most important events of the year, Ignite Your Superpower STEM Day. It's a gathering of some 700 Central Indiana middle school girls focused on honing their science, technology, engineering, and math skills. Joining me now to talk about why this signature event is so important to Indiana and the business community is Iowood Director and Chair Karen McGinn. Karen, as always, welcome.
Thank you.
This Ignite Your Superpower event is an interesting concept. Started, this is the third year, started a couple of years ago. And from the beginning, this has been very popular. I think you had 600 plus in that first year. Talk about the idea and what this Ignite Your Superpower event is all about.
Thank you. The Ignite Your Superpower is for the 7th and 6th graders through the IPS in Warren Township and Indian Creek. Our first year, we had well over 600 students that came, and they got so excited. They got engaged. They were having hands-on experiences with all of our vendors. We had several superhero volunteers mm-hmm. that were leading the students around, and we were excited to see that they were coming away saying, I thought my brother could do this.
Right.
I thought my only, you know, I didn't know it was me.
And probably a big attraction, too, is the fact it really is a hands-on. Talk about some of the things that these young girls are going to be doing at this event.
Okay. Yes. So we have 3D printers that will be coming in. We also have where they'll be making snow, slime, you know, all kinds of things where they get really excited. They want want to really dive in, get engaged, mm-hmm. you know, have that experience. And with our volunteers, we have several superheroes. 250 this year will be guiding the students through the STEM room, and they are role models within the tech community, mm-hmm. and they will be answering questions and giving them insight and mm-hmm. Just encouraging them and giving them that self-confidence. And last year, we had a couple of students that walked away saying, I could see myself here on, you know, on the college campus, because mm-hmm. our partners that help us get the Ignite Your Superpower together is Women in High Tech, Connor Prairie, mm-hmm. as well as, of course, IUPUI, where that will be where we're hosting again this year. And they see themselves on the yeah. college campus. They can see themselves there. And a few of the girls even said, I could see myself being a scientist yeah. or an engineer. And that's so exciting to yeah. see those girls just get so excited about what
and,
the opportunities.
And again, important to get them engaged at an early age, which this event does. IWIT very much involved in the IWIT LPGA Championship at the Brickyard again this year, third year. That too has a component very much about exposing not only the organization, but also young girls and boys as well to STEM fields.
Yes, so we are having our third year for the IWIT Championship LPGA. It's hosted at IMS at the Brickyard Crossing, and that full week we have different events, Eureka Exchange, which is a STEM event, and our IWIT Summit. And it's been a wonderful platform to make awareness of indie women in tech, making sure that we have sponsorships and donors. And for example, we had $180,000 raised last year that goes to the IWIT Foundation to support our education for the women, as well as our STEM days. And I wanted to also mention that this year we did, we're thrilled, we got a award from Junior League of Indianapolis, $20,000 wow. to support us to have a successful IYS this year.
Very good. Indy Women in Tech, great organization. And again, the event coming up, Ignite Your Superpower event for 6th and 7th grade girls, August 22 at IUPUI. Karen McGinn, as always, thanks very much and congratulations on the success.
Thank you.
All right.
Appreciate it.
Well, engineers certainly play key roles in influencing some of the world's most impressive and life-changing innovations. But the engineering field is one that is in need of more skilled talent. And as we continue our Indiana's Future Ready Workforce series with Project Lead the Way, pleased to welcome Rolls-Royce engineer Cameron Crenshaw to explain how interaction with companies helps put students on the path to careers in STEM fields. And Cameron, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
A little bit about your background. You are a Shelby County grew up in Shelby County, right?
Yep.
Tell us about your path.
Absolutely, yeah. So grew up in rural Shelby County. Actually transferred high schools to Shelbyville High School for these Project Lead the Way courses. So
yeah.
Knew that I wanted to do engineering from a young age. So
yeah, and you're, I think, you know, somewhat unique in that you knew you really had a feeling and a passion for engineering.
Right.
And so made the decision to go to Shelbyville High School, mm-hmm. right? And these Project Lead the Way courses, and we're partnering with them on this, but talk about how they really engaged you and gave you that hands-on, real-life, real-world experience.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think for me, you know, number one, it cemented that desire that I wanted to be an engineer, that that's the career I wanted to choose. But I think really it taught me the basics of engineering much earlier than I would have gotten them if I didn't have the courses and just went to college or had to do some on-the-job learning. And really just helped me get those, you know, get my feet under me in engineering pretty early.
How important, in your view, is that early exposure to the hands-on, to maybe understand that you do want to do it, or maybe you don't want to do the engineering?
Yeah, exactly. No, I think that's huge. You know, a lot of people, I think, they get halfway through college, and then they yeah. say, oh, this isn't what I want to do, and then they have to, you know, yeah. start over. You know, in my case, like I said, it confirmed that that's what I wanted to do, but I think for a lot of people, if engineering is not what you want to do, it's a great way to find that out as well, much earlier than you would otherwise.
Put in perspective the challenge for companies like Rolls and many others in attracting and keep that engineering talent. How dramatic is the need to boost the pipeline?
Yeah, no, it's incredibly huge. I do remember, you know, just from my perspective, when I interviewed, I had these Project Lead the Way courses on my resume, and I remember getting the response, oh, well, then we don't have to teach you the basics. We can start you out on this. We need people working on this advanced project. Mm-hmm. So it accelerates, so you have to spend less time training those new employees.
Talk about your job. You are a component designer, right?
Design engineer.
Yeah. Talk about what you do on a daily basis at Rolls, which is such a huge part of the Indiana economy.
Yeah. So personally, what I do, a lot of component design is, you know, checking and writing reports, and then going again, drawing, modeling on the computer, all those sorts of things. But really, I mean, the group that I'm in is working on a lot of really futuristic advanced products. And I know that, you know, the B-52 program is something that we've announced that is going to be huge for the area. And so most of my day job, honestly, is I get to work on really cool stuff. And that's what I get to tell people.
Yeah. Final question. Do you sense that teachers and also maybe students are starting to engage, starting to understand what you understood at a young age and really beginning to get engaged in these types of hands-on programs?
Yeah, absolutely. I have seen just through programs that, you know, Rolls has helped sponsor, you know, their major sponsor of FIRST robotics teams in the area, which I was also a member of. You know, programs like that have been helpful for a long time, but actually getting the classroom instruction has been huge, I think. And it does seem like more and more people that I talk to are really starting to understand they can make that decision earlier, and that's a huge help.
Filling that STEM pipeline, Cameron Crenshaw is an engineer at Rolls-Royce. Cameron, thanks for joining us. Good luck going forward.
Thank you.
Well, the Alzheimer's Association of Greater Indiana Chapter is backing its mission by making its largest research grant ever. Business of Health reporter Kylie Valletta is here now to talk about how the money pushes a prestigious IU School of Medicine study to the next level. Kylie.
That's right, Gary. About 1 year ago, the IU School of Medicine landed its largest single grant from the National Institutes of Health. The $45 million award tapped the university to lead a 5-year national research study focused on the youngest patients with Alzheimer's. The project is called LEADS, and here to tell us about the impact of the new $1 million gift is the study's lead researcher, Dr. Leanna Apostolova, a professor at the IU School of Medicine, and Natalie Sutton, executive director of the Alzheimer's Association Greater Indiana Chapter. Thank you both for coming to the show.
Thank you, Kylie.
Dr. Apostolova, let's start with you in the LEADS program. It focuses on early onset Alzheimer's, which is especially devastating form of the disease. Tell us a little bit about early onsets, how it impacts patients and families.
Of course, yeah. What we know about Alzheimer's is really all coming from the late version of the disease, which is 95% of those who are affected with Alzheimer's. About 5% or 200 to 300,000 in the United States, though, have an early onset form, that is those that are less than 65 years old. They could be as young as 40, as young as 50. They could be our age ladies. And guess what? These people are still in the workforce. They're not ready to retire. They're raising children or supporting them through college. And they don't have any long-term plans and insurance set in motion to be able to take time off work, let alone go on disability. So it is a tremendous impact for the family.
And Natalie, let's talk about the $1 million grant that your organization is providing the study and how it really kicks it up a notch.
It really does. The NIH funding, obviously significant, and allows data collection from all over the country for the study. But the initial NIH funding only funded researchers to look at about 2% of the genome. So our $1 million grant is going to enable the researchers to study the entire genome of all 600 patients across the country. And we believe that there might be some underlying risk factors that we could uncover by looking at the entire genome in these patients.
So, Dr. Apostolova, you're focusing on early onset, but studying that, do you learn more about Alzheimer's disease in general?
Yes, of course, especially with the genetics portion of it. We know of about maybe 30, 40 genetic risk factors for the late onset version of the disease, but still so much of that genetic risk is missing. We see that in families where Alzheimer's disease has hit, that these individuals, their children, their siblings are more likely to develop Alzheimer's, and we need to know more about what causes this risk. And by studying early onset, we will be able to see the most aggressive genes that we have not discovered simply because we have not looked at patients this young. Mm-hmm. So these would be important discoveries for all of Alzheimer's and would also lead to downstream research that will allow us to study disease mechanisms and to uncover new therapeutic targets.
Mm-hmm. So, Natalie, early onset, because it's rare, is it less studied? And did that help the organization decide how to direct its dollars?
Absolutely. This group of patients has really not been studied by other research in the past. So much of the early onset research has focused on the familial form of the disease. And at the Alzheimer's Association, we're looking at the entire scope of research. We're really pleased that our organization nationally has been behind this study from the beginning, but also really proud here in Indiana that this important research in the field is taking place in our backyard. So it was a great opportunity for our local board of directors to support this work.
And speaking of research taking place here, Hoosiers are involved. Tell us how we can get more involved.
Well, we're still recruiting. So we're looking for individuals who are cognitively impaired between the ages of 40 and 64 at 15 locations across the nation and, of course, in Indiana. So if there is anyone that you that these are...
Anyone that knows,
please go, come call us, call Indiana University, and visit us at the website, www.leads-study.org.
Great work taking place right here in Indiana, Indianapolis. Thank you both for being here today.
No problem.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Inside Indiana Business is the Hoosier State's only statewide business program. You get to hear programs with Inside Indiana Business here on Lakeshore Public Radio. And you can also find more Inside Indiana Business on-air programs going online to insideindianabusiness.com or go onto the YouTube channel and search for Inside Indiana Business. Teachers of color feel undervalued and less visible in their schools compared to their white peers. And that's according to a new report that's out this week. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jeannie Lindsay has more about the challenges to diversify the teaching workforce and what experts say would help.
The Teach Plus report lists more challenges, like the financial cost to teach and a lack of cultural awareness in schools. And Director of Research Mark Teo says schools and states should find solutions by listening to teachers. He says that can happen with data collected by exit interviews and surveys, but it shouldn't stop there.
But then you can also do things like hold teacher cabinets or conduct less formal kinds of research to hear from classroom teachers on what their experiences are.
Teo says some solutions are more resource-dependent than others. The report also recommends offering financial incentives to support teachers from Black and Latinx communities as they support students. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jeannie Lindsay.
Indiana Secretary of State Connie Lawson wants to reassure Hoosiers that their votes will be secure when they go to the polls. Illinois and Arizona had their voter registration systems breached in 2016, and that's put other states, including Indiana, on alert. Lawson says that the state has invested in detection and prevention systems, and she says a private cybersecurity firm is monitoring attempts to infiltrate state voter databases, scans, that she says happen all the time.
And it's like a burglar coming up to your front door and rattling the door handle to see if the house is locked. Our house is locked.
Connie Lawson says security measures go beyond technology upgrades, for instance, with private companies that help supply election equipment.
By requiring vendors to have background checks for all of their employees and requiring vendors to file a statement of any foreign ownership in their companies.
The Secretary of State, Connie Lawson, says that the state also moved its voter registration data to a private server, something that she says the federal authorities told her would significantly help protect it. And that's it for Regionally Speaking for Reporters Roundtable Thursday. Our thanks to Grant Morgan from the Post Tribune for his stories that he put in online and in print. From Inside Indiana Business, Gary Dick and his team of guests. From Lakeshore Public Radio's Sharon Jackson, and from Indiana Public Broadcasting, State House reporter Brandon Smith for his story today. And we thank you for joining us. I'm Chris Nolte. We'll be back with you at a new time on Monday. We'll be on the air with Regionally Speaking at 11 o'clock noontime, the new all-in program coming from Indianapolis. We hope you'll join us, though, for Regionally Speaking on Monday at 11.